Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. freezes some of its funding to aid for the Palestinians. Lawmakers in Washington are continuing to debate immigration policy as a government shutdown looms.
Building a wall is not going to stop people coming over. I don't know how high the wall is proposed to be, but if you give me a 20-foot wall, I'll build a 22-foot ladder.
Talks on how to stop North Korea's nuclear program continue in Vancouver, Canada. Also ahead, new details on the sudden death of a well-known singer. Foreign ministers from 20 nations meeting in Vancouver, Canada, said sanctions pressure on North Korea must continue until it abandons its nuclear weapons program. Tuesday's ministerial talks come just days after a mistaken missile alert sparked panic in Hawaii, a sharp reminder of the fears over North Korea's growing nuclear capability. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the gathering of like-minded nations sends North Korean leader Kim Jong-un a unified message.
We must increase the cost of the regime's behavior to the point that North Korea comes to the table for credible negotiations. The object of negotiations, if and when we get there, is the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of North Korea.
The top U.S. diplomat urged China and Russia, which didn't attend, to fully implement U.N. sanctions against North Korea. President Donald Trump criticized Democratic lawmakers Tuesday, saying their demands to include protections for young undocumented immigrants could lead to a government shutdown. With Capitol Hill still seething over President Trump's reported slur of predominantly black nations, lawmakers sought to salvage a bipartisan immigration deal. That's 3 days before that government shutdown, potential government shutdown. The White House congressional talks about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA, are linked to urgent meetings this week, with Friday at midnight being the deadline. Last September, Trump signed an executive order ending DACA, a program started by former President Barack Obama, but gave Congress until March 5th to weigh in on the issue. Joining us now to discuss is Mark Ensilaco, the first director of the newly formed Human Rights Studies Program at the University of Dayton. So what's your view in all of this?
DACA and the budget agreement. I think they should be separate. DACA stands alone. It's a moral issue. It's an important social issue, and they should be separate. But they're obviously connected because Democrats feel that if they don't tie DACA to the budget, then they will have no leverage in a government where you have Republicans in control of the White House and both houses of Congress. So substantively, they should be separate. But the politics of it is that Democrats will come out with nothing, potentially, if they don't connect them.
These are people that came here into this country as children with their parents who were undocumented, and this is the only life they know. Is illegal immigration posing financial issues for our country?
I must know 24 people are in this country without DACA. I know dreamers. I know a dreamer who was the valedictorian at a local high school and then fell into a deep depression because couldn't get student loans to go on to college, even though he had been the valedictorian. I see them work. I see them work in landscaping. I see them work in automotive. I see them in roofing, in construction. I see them in all sorts of things. They work incredibly, incredibly hard. They earn money and they send money back to their families. They pay taxes. So no, it's not a burden at all. That has been an argument that has been raised for many, many years, but there are no reputable studies to support that view that immigrants, whether they're documented or not, drive down wages, or that undocumented aliens receive benefits and are on a burden, economic burden to this country.
President says he's willing to trade his wall that he wants for a DACA agreement. Do we need that wall with Mexico? The president says people are pouring in.
The president contradicts himself. I mean, the president on one day boasts that illegal entries are at an all-time low without a wall. So it raises the question about the wall. We're talking about $18 billion. It's another thing that I think most Americans are unaware of, that a great many people enter this country legally and overstay their visas. I mean, that is a significant percentage. So building a wall is not going to stop people coming over. I don't know how high the wall is proposed to be, but if you give me a 20-foot wall, I'll build a 22-foot ladder. I've believed for a very long time that when I think about human rights, that people have a right not to have to leave their country. And so we really need to address issues in Central America, the Triangle, Mexico, and other countries. But this idea that immigrants coming to this country are a burden, or that we need a wall. It's kind of shameful, having grown up old enough to remember the construction of the Berlin Wall and then that glorious moment of tearing down the, mm-hmm. the Berlin Wall in 1989. Now, they're not the mm-hmm. same thing because mm-hmm. this wall's not intended to keep our people out, but keep others come in. But just that idea of a 2,000-mile wall, whether it's a wall or a virtual wall or a fence, is just something as an American that makes me terribly uncomfortable.
There seems to be somewhat of an anti-immigrant sentiment in the current administration. This is quite a turn from a country that always seemed to be a nation of immigrants. But the president says this is a matter of national security. Do you agree with this? Did we overplay our hand with the welcome mat?
No. I mean, I would like to know one undocumented alien from anywhere in Latin America that has been accused of or has committed an act of terror in this country. I mean, this is an absurd argument. It's not a question of national security at all. There are deep anti-immigrant sentiments in this country. I encounter them all the time. You know, there are proposals by members of Congress not just to block undocumented aliens, but to restrict immigration altogether, and particularly from those asshole countries where we don't appreciate those things. We talk about undocumented aliens. I'm an Italian from New York, and the derogatory term long ago was WOPs. We were WOPs. We were without papers. That's the origin of that. So I mean, whether it's the Irish, whether it's the Italians, now Latin Americans, this anti-immigrant sentiment has always been a part of the American culture. But the problem now is that President of the United States, who's catering to that because he believes his base supports that. And I hear those voices all the time. From a human rights perspective, the Universal Declaration of Rights says really clearly that the family is the fundamental unit of society and deserves special protection. And the president talks about chain migration. There's no such term as chain migration. What he's really talking about is family unification. He doesn't want that to happen. Someone comes into this country and they're able to bring, you know, some immediate family members into this country for us to welcome them. So this, for a country and a party in particular, talks about family values, to now demonize chain migration, which is really family unification, is something that is just mystifying. I was contacted by the principal of my daughter's school because Immigration and Customs Enforcement had detained and deported the father of one of the students. Mm-hmm. And the principal called me sort of in a panic, and what are we going to do? And I tried to assess the situation. So just put this. This school believes there are 20 families in the exact same situation. This is a student. This is a school you must audition to enter. Really talented. It's an art school. Really talented students. Don't speak Spanish. You're never in Latin America. But 20 families are in the same situation where they could face. They could come out of school, expecting to be picked up by their mother and father and not have them there because they're already in an orange jumpsuit. Mm. So I think as Americans, we talk about the rule of law and we talk about enforcing the law and we talk about our sovereignty and border security and national security. I think average Americans, including those who voted for the president, really need to look their neighbors in the eyes and just ask themselves if they were in similar situations. Imagine some scenario where the daily rhythms of your family life were upset, and then recognize that in many ways these are just, in the case of the deportations, this is just whimsical acts by the government that are not supported by any justified need.
That's Dr. Mark Ensolaco, professor at the University of Dayton. We appreciate your perspective. Well, the Trump administration is withholding $65 million from a UN agency that provides humanitarian aid to Palestinian refugees. The United States had planned to contribute a $125 million installment to the UN Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA. It will instead send $60 million. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert explained to reporters what it means.
It's money that's being frozen at this time. It's not being canceled. It's just being held for future consideration. One of the things that the United States would like to do is see some revisions made in how UNRWA operates.
UNRWA's primary mission is providing health care, education, and other services to Palestinians living in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia, what he thinks of this move.
Well, I personally found the move to be very unchivalrous. It's one thing for the Trump administration in its peak to say we're going to cut, for instance, security assistance and other direct assistance to the Palestinian Authority. It's quite another to cut assistance to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East. That is an organization that was set up, has been administered in the past 50 years at various times by Americans. It is something with a UN mandate to provide educational and food assistance to Palestinian refugees. And that's quite distinct from the PLO. It's quite distinct from the Palestinian Authority. We're talking food rations and schooling for Palestinian refugee children who have nothing to do with the politics of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And so I personally find it disgraceful that the Trump administration would do this. I think that sending messages to the PLO is one thing, to the Palestinian Authority, but this is not the way to do it. UNRWA, as it's known, has been chronically short of funds in recent years. There's always been complaints, notably from Israel and the United States, about how UNRWA's money is spent, but at heart, those are political complaints. But to seek to punish the Palestinians for, as the president said, a lack of gratitude or a perceived lack of movement on the peace process by going after UNRWA is not only, as I said, unchivalrous, but I think it could lead to some real humanitarian problems that are only going to worsen the search for peace in the region.
Danny Dannon, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, said UNRWA has proven time and again to be an agency that misuses the aid, as you suggested earlier, and instead supports anti-Israel propaganda, perpetuates the plight of Palestinian refugees, and encourages hate. Can you respond to that?
The Israeli government for decades has criticized UNRWA for, as the Mr. Dannon just said, quote, perpetuating the refugee problem. The problem with the refugees is that over the decades, they have almost uniformly said they want to return home. The Arab states have said they're not going to resettle them in the Arab countries. The refugees don't want to be resettled in the Arab countries. The problem of the refugees is not one of lack of will or lack of desire from either the Palestinian refugees themselves or the Arab states to resettle them. It's a political question. And the UN itself has recognized the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes if they want. It's a political decision. But to criticize a UN agency that was set up in 1949, to deal with the needs of refugees in the meantime, as themselves contributing to the problem, is tantamount to people in the United States criticizing welfare for the fact that there's poverty in the first place. So I find that highly disingenuous. And again, it falls into a long pattern of Israeli politicians and conservatives in the United States criticizing UNRWA for allegedly this, that, or the other thing, when the heart of the matter is that Israel and the Palestinians are going to have to deal, as part of a peace process, with what to do with the Palestinian refugees.
Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The White House physician says President Trump is fit for duty. An ex-U.S. intelligence officer arrested for retaining classified information. Is Britain heading for a rerun Brexit vote? And Kenya's opposition leader is vowing to inaugurate himself as the people's president. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In California, a 17-year-old girl called police after escaping from her family's home, where she and her 12 brothers and sisters were locked up in filthy conditions, some so malnourished that police officers at first believed all were children, even though seven were actually adults. Police went to the family home southeast of Los Angeles Sunday, where deputies found several children shackled to their beds with chains and padlocks in dark, foul-smelling surroundings. The siblings range in age from 2 to 29. 57-year-old David Allen Turpin and 49-year-old Louise Anna Turpin each were held on $9 million bail. That's the parents. Joining us now to talk about the legal implications of this, Los Angeles-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro. So, wow, this is quite a story. How unusual is something like this?
This one is pretty unique. This one is pretty unique for a number of reasons. One would be the age of how long this apparently has been going on, the number of children involved, you know, and the fact that no one really caught on to this sooner in a residential community.
Right.
You know, a lot of times you see this sort of in a backwood area where there's not a lot of pedestrian traffic, there's not a lot of neighborly traffic. You know, and here you have neighbors saying, well, you know, we saw a couple of kids, they look pale, and we thought it was kind of weird that they had all these kids and no one played in the street, you know, and here we are. So it's pretty unique, especially, you know, especially being so close to where we are in Southern California here in San Diego.
Wow. And apparently, like you said, it seemed to law enforcement officials that this had been going on for a long time.
Yeah. My understanding of it is that it was definitely going on for a while, you know, which doesn't make it. I mean, the reality is if it was going on for 10 minutes, it's 10 minutes too long.
Right.
But the fact it was going on for a while really leads to the depth of it and the depth of the, I mean, for lack of a better word, how sick these individuals were. You know, I want to say as a criminal defense attorney, you know, you're trained to say, assuming it's true. But the reality is I don't know what a viable defense would be to lock your children up in these conditions. You know, as a parent, there is none.
Right. So what kind of charges would be brought against these people?
Well, I believe they got booked on child endangerment or child abuse charges. That in and of itself could carry 6 years in state prison for one of the children. And I believe they were also booked into jail on torture charges based on certain situations, whether it was starving the children or harming them. You know, torture itself, if certain allegations are filed in California, could wind up being a life imprisonment type case. My belief is that if they charge it per child, and there's going to be a myriad of charges they could charge them with, for all intents and purposes, it's going to be a lifetime case. Whether it's a life case where it's a certain period of time to life if they get convicted, or if it's just an enormous prison sentence, assuming they are convicted, just because all these years will just add up and add up and add up. I mean, these are people that, if a third of it is true, you know, are probably not going to see the light of day, ironically enough, because that's what they've been doing to their kids, but they won't see the light of day outside of a prison or a jail cell, probably for the rest of their natural lives.
So I guess my next question would be irrelevant, and that would they be able to ever get those kids back?
No, because probably not, because even if they're not convicted in court, and assuming they will be, but even if they're not, you know, there are situations where allegations of abuse are made. Child welfare services will do their own independent investigation, even if criminal charges are not filed, and they could step in and have dependency proceedings separate and apart from the criminal case where, you know, they could take your child from you and not necessarily convict you of a crime. You know, that's sort of like the stairway of burdens of proof that a lot of attorneys argue is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case, the standard to take your child away is actually lower than that. And it's easier for, in this case, child welfare services to meet that standard. So, I mean, I think the real issue is how much time they're going to do. I don't think there's a way, whether it's through the criminal case, because there would be criminal protective orders where they wouldn't be allowed to be around their children. Yeah, and even if there isn't a criminal case, I think child welfare services and the dependency court steps in and ensures these children are protected from their natural parents any further.
What happens to these kids and the ones that are of adult age but are probably incapable of taking care of themselves at this point?
Yeah, that's a real tough thing. I think the easier thing would be the younger ones because obviously, you know, I don't know if there's family involved and the issue is how if the family was close to these kids and they knew something was up or were part of it themselves, more likely than not. And if it's distant family, then what's the difference between putting these kids with distant family versus stranger? If they had no real connection to the outside world, let alone their family outside of that property. A lot of therapy, I don't even know if that's going to be enough, you know, under what's been reported. You know, but it's something that the young adults now and the kids, any situation, even though they might not think that now because it might be so messed up because of what they had to go through, any situation other than being in that environment, I think would be a step up.
All right. Los Angeles-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro, thanks for being with us. Meanwhile, a nutrition expert says the children may have been deprived of nutrients during key growth spurt years, which can lock kids into their smaller bodies with further growth impossible. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now with the latest entertainment news, and for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. So, really sad news this week that's just really shocking to so many people. At 46 years old, the lead singer of the Cranberries, Dolores O'Riordan, found dead. No cause of death as of yet. I'm sure there's been lots of reaction to this.
Friends and family of Dolores are reacting to the news now in the few hours since her death broke and made headlines. Her longtime friend and somebody who was working with the Cranberries record label, Dan White, spoke to People magazine on Tuesday, and he said that he had received a voicemail from Dolores within hours before she died, around midnight on, I guess it would be early Monday morning. He said that she left a voicemail and said she was really, really excited about getting back in the studio. She had plans to return and do a remix of Zombie with a band called Bad Wolves. And he told People that he was very sad to hear the news of the death. He said it was devastating. And he said in her voicemail she was making jokes and she seemed very happy and full of life. So this was really, really sudden to him and even to her bandmates. The Cranberries released a statement on Twitter on Monday saying that they were devastated and they felt privileged to have her as part of her life.
Wow, just heartbreaking for sure. Let's end this on a lighter note. The big talk is the big wedding, the royal wedding between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And I understand there's actually going to be a movie about their love story.
Yes, as if watching the royal wedding on May 19th isn't enough for some royals fans. There will be a Lifetime original movie about Harry and Meghan's love story. I guess the working title I'm hearing is Harry and Meghan, the royal love story. So it's going to kind of chronicle their whole relationship from introduction all the way up to engagement and maybe even some of the wedding. So stay tuned for some more of that. I'm assuming it'll come out somewhere between April and May.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for talking to us. Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Well, a new animated feature from four-time Oscar-winning director Nick Park, Early Man, stars the voices of Tom Hiddleston, Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne, and Game of Thrones star Maisie Williams. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the movie looks at the clash of technology and human nature from a whimsical perspective.
Meet Doug's tribe. They rocked the Stone Age. But a new age is dawning.
The Edge of Stone is over. Long live the Edge of Bronze.
Doug and his tribe are firmly in the Stone Age. Their biggest pursuit is hunting rabbits. But one day, their peaceful existence is overturned when the evil Lord Nuth rides in on his bronze-clad mammoth. Nuth wants to take the tribe's valley to mine it for precious metals. But Doug challenges Nuth's soccer team to a match for the valley. Eddie Redmayne provides the voice of Doug and said at the film's premiere that he has loved the work at Aardman Animations for years and was delighted to work on the film.
I was obsessed with that Creature Comforts and Wallace and Gromit, and so I never thought I would get this call. And getting to work with Nick Park and going down to Aardman in Bristol to their studios, it's pretty unbelievable.
Maisie Williams, best known for her work as Arya Stark on the hit HBO fantasy drama Game of Thrones, plays Guna, a talented football player who is not allowed to play the game because she is female. Guna switches sides and helps Doug's team in the pivotal football match. Maisie Williams says that she hopes her character serves as an inspiration to young girls worldwide.
And I think it's so beautiful to play a character that's so strong for a film that will be watched by a lot of the younger generation and will be watched by a lot of kids and will influence a lot of kids. And I think like everything about her, from her look to her story arc to like how she changes over the film and to, you know, the values that she stands by, I think she's just wonderful, wonderful for everyone.
Tom Hiddleston provides the voice for Lord Nuth, who speaks with a comically overdone French accent. Director Nick Park says that the decision to give Nuth that accent was made for one reason, because it was funny.
Just giving him a French accent seemed to work the best. And Tom can do anything. He can mimic anyone and do any accent. So we tried different things, but we landed on the French just because it seemed to suit his buffoonery and he's a sort of middle manager who's a climber in society and quite avaricious. And he's not a kind of hard villain. He's not a sort of mustache-twirling. He's not a dark villain. He's more of a comedy villain.
Even in the age of computer-generated graphics, this film was done using the plasticine stop-motion animation that Nick Park has been famous for in the Wallace and Gromit films, as well as the award-winning Shaun the Sheep television series. Early Man opens in U.S. theaters February 16th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons, also known as modern slavery or human trafficking, is a global multi-billion dollar crime and egregious human rights abuse that robs individuals of their freedom. It splinters communities, threatens public safety and national security, distorts economic markets, and undermines rule of law. It feeds corruption, fuels other criminal activity, and helps fund terrorist activities. The International Labor Organization estimates that 24.9 million people are victims of human trafficking globally. Of these, 16 million people are in forced labor exploitation, nearly 5 million in forced sexual exploitation, and 4 million persons in state-imposed forced labor. No country in the world is immune to human trafficking. It is happening in every corner of the globe, in people's homes, in factories, in hotels, on farms, on fishing vessels, in countless places where one might not expect it. Human trafficking also happens in the United States. This means that if we are to fight this scourge, we must begin at home. That is why January is declared by presidential proclamation National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. President Donald Trump continued that tradition, stating in his proclamation that human traffickers prey on their victims by promising a life of hope and greater opportunity while delivering only enslavement. Instead of delivering people to better lives, traffickers unjustifiably profit from the labor and toil of their victims, who they force, through violence and intimidation, to work in brothels and factories, on farms and fishing vessels, in private homes, and in countless industries. The president further emphasized that during National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month, we recommit ourselves to eradicating the evil of enslavement. Human trafficking is a modern form of the oldest and most barbaric type of exploitation. It has no place in our world. This month, we do not simply reflect on this appalling reality. We also pledge to do all in our power to end the horrific practice of human trafficking that plagues innocent victims around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Washington.